This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
The BC Liberal government has given Providence Healthcare a grant of $1 million to come up with two business plans for St. Paul's Hospital. One of the plans involves building a brand new hospital near Main and Terminal under a public-private partnership, or P3. We decided to find out more about P3s in Canada and elsewhere, so we've contacted Natalie Mira. She's director of the Ontario Health Coalition. The coalition is campaigning against a number of proposed P3 hospitals in Ontario. Natalie Mira is also the author of a recent report on P3s called Flawed, Failed, and Abandoned. And we've reached her this morning in North Bay, Ontario, where the coalition is organizing a plebiscite against a proposed P3 hospital there. Hello, Natalie.
Hi there.
Now, this is just one of several plebiscites that you're organizing. What kind of response have you had to your efforts so far?
It's been terrific. So a plebiscite is a citizen called vote, like a referendum, but it's actually run by the citizens. We've done one in St. Catharines, and you can actually hear the noise of the campaign office, I think, behind me. We've done one in St. Catharines. 13,000 people voted, and 98% of them voted against the P3 privatization of their hospital. We're in North Bay now. The vote is happening today. There are hundreds of volunteers out all over the community, and they're getting in votes. I think we've got the first 3,000 or 4,000 in right now, and looking forward to the rest of the day.
Now, I want to turn to the report. How many different projects did you examine in the report?
Well, we actually had to cut it down. There is a major report put out by the Canadian Council for Public-Private Partnerships. It's the pro-P3 lobby group. It's the industry lobby group that's trying to win these contracts in order to make profit from the hospitals. And they listed 100 projects across Canada that were P3s, and it's being used to make policymakers think that it's no big deal to bring in P3s. But many of the projects that they were listing were, you know, terribly flawed or had significant problems with them. So we wrote a report that looked at 100 failed, flawed, or abandoned privatized P3s. And the only difficulty in doing that was actually getting the list down to 100.
Now, there are examples from Canada and Australia and the UK. And in Canada, not many of the examples are hospitals, but in the UK they are.
That's right. I think they've done now 169 P3 hospitals in the UK. And they're quite well studied. Evidence from them is quite shocking.
What were some of the consistent problems that came up in hospital after hospital?
Well, the major one clear problem is that the high costs of the P3s have put the hospitals into debt, and significant debt, so that in the first round they had to reduce clinical budgets, sort of suck money out of clinical budgets to the bricks and mortar and to the profit seeking of the consortiums, the groups of private companies that were taking over, you know, half of the hospital. And then, of course, even having done that to pay the higher cost of the hospital at the beginning, they continue to have to cut costs in the hospital in order to finance ever more fees and additional cost increases from the private sector. And so now they're finding that the P3 hospitals in Britain are much more likely to be in debt than non-P3 hospitals, that they've continued to cut community health services, doctors, nurses, support staff, and hospital beds and programs in order to fund the deficits, which are primarily due to the P3s.
What is the scale of the cost overruns? Because, of course, we're familiar with cost overruns. Anytime there's a public project, there's bound to be some kind of cost overrun. But what is the scale in the P3s?
I think part of the confusion around this issue comes from the fact that there are cost overruns in the construction of any large complex projects. At least that's what our research shows. So large projects, be they done in the private sector or in the public sector, tend to have significant cost overruns. But what they've seen in the P3s is that the cost overruns increase during the negotiation of the deal, as the private sector negotiates more and more things into the contract that they want. And so we've seen cost escalations that are just massive in these P3s. For example, the Brampton P3 hospital in Ontario, the cost increased from $350 million at the outlying business case, so that the business case that they put forward at the beginning of the negotiation with the private sector. And by the time they signed the deal, that hospital cost $550 million.
So almost double then.
$200 million increase on a $350 million hospital. Absolutely shocking increase with no explanation at all. And in fact, the size of the hospital during that period actually shrunk. So it's a smaller hospital. Nobody will tell the community how many beds are going to be in that hospital now. And the cost almost doubled.
Now, I was really shocked to read in your report about design hospitals. There's a hospital in Durham in the UK, and some areas of the hospital are unbearably hot. The pharmacy is next to the mortuary and doesn't have a waiting room, so people see bodies go by as they wait for their prescriptions. And then there's large parts of the hospital that have no drinking water because the cold water taps run hot. Is this typical of the scope of the design flaws that you found?
Yes, and in fact, some of them have been worse. Recently, actually just this summer, a story emerged of a hospital in West Leeds in the UK. It's a mental health facility, and it was so shoddily constructed that now they think that they have to tear down the hospital. There was another hospital in the London area where the financier went bankrupt halfway through. So that hospital, they just walked away from it half-built, and that's happened with dozens of P3 schools in the UK, leaving parents scrambling in the middle of summer to move their children onto other school roles. That also happened in the United States with a bunch of P3 schools that the company hit financial problems just before the school year, sold off all the computers and books, and actually tried to convince parents to let the children provide the support services, the cleaning, the phone answering, and so on in the schools in order to reduce their costs. And thankfully, you know, the parents fought back and, you know, refused to do that and forced the company to stop it. But these sorts of problems are epidemic in P3s because, you know, you've turned what was once a public enterprise that was run on a not-for-profit basis into a profit-seeking commercial entity. One hospital, I was shocked at this in the UK, and actually this isn't just one hospital, several hospitals told us that when patients go in, they have reps come in to try and sell them their TV package and their phone package and so on. It's all run for profit in the hospital. And if they refuse to buy the TV package, which is quite pricey, they're subject to an endless loop of TV advertising on the TV screens in front of their beds, and the TVs don't turn off. You can't turn them off.
Like a kind of punishment, then.
Absolutely.
Now, 11 of the 64 Canadian projects that you looked at had actually been abandoned. What kind of reasons led to the projects being shelved?
Cost increases, often a total breakdown between the public not-for-profit part of the service and the for-profit companies as they were negotiating the deals, sometimes community fight-backs as costs escalated in the deals, or as the secrecy of the commercial deals turned off citizens. Different things actually caused the cancellation. Some of them the companies pulled out of because they weren't able to get the terms for the deals that they wanted.
In your campaign against P3 hospitals, you've been traveling around with a very large wooden horse. Why a horse?
Well, it's the Trojan horse. So it's supposed to be the Trojan horse of hospital privatization. And so it's been brought in as if is a gift. A new hospital is coming as a gift, but hidden in the middle of it is this toxic deal that actually will reduce health services, not increase them. And so it's kind of an apt metaphor, the Trojan horse.
And do you find that people kind of really respond to that metaphor?
Absolutely, and the horse is, absolutely huge. So it gets lots of attention, and there's big signs on it saying the Trojan horse of health privatization and so on. So people really respond to that. And we've done leafleting outside of plant gates and malls and community activities in literally over 50 or 60 now, I think, towns across Ontario, and reached tens of thousands of people through that.
Have there been successes in the fight against P3s in Canada, P3 hospitals?
Well, I think certainly the community fight back has slowed them way down. I the intention of our previous government in Ontario was to push through many more projects than they eventually ever got through. And even now, there are no P3 hospitals built in Canada yet. They are constructing the one at Abbotsford, the one in Brampton, the one in Ottawa. So we only have three projects in Canada, and the industry is facing a major fight against them from citizens that are concerned about giving up control over our public assets and our public services and turning them into commercial entities. In every town that we've been to, people, when they learn that this is the plan, are absolutely shocked and appalled and want to stop it. And so it doesn't matter whether the political culture of the town is that they vote Conservative or they vote Liberal or they vote NDP. Here, en masse, thousands of people come out to vote to stop the privatization of our hospitals.
Well, thanks so much for taking time out of your campaign morning this morning in North Bay. Thank you very much, Natalie.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Natalie Mira. She's director of the Ontario Health Coalition. You can find a copy of her report, which is titled Flawed, Failed, Abandoned, and that's on the Ontario Health Coalition website. And you're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
No South African oranges for breakfast, no South African wines for dinner, and no South African teams in international sports competitions. Boycotts, divestment, and sanctions were an important and effective tactic in the struggle to end apartheid in South Africa. More and more people have come to recognize that Israel, too, has created an apartheid system of rule over Palestinians. So it's not surprising that calls for economic sanctions against Israel also are being heard. Erica Lamacraft attended an international conference in Toronto at the end of October as a delegate of Canada-Palestine Support Network. The conference was church-initiated, and it focused on developing a campaign of economic pressures on Israel. And Erica joins me in the studio. Good morning, Erica.
Good morning, Mordecai, and good morning to the Red Eye Collective.
Why is it now that churches are sort of exploring the possibility of economic sanctions against Israel?
Well, it's not a move that has come out of the blue. These churches have been involved in the conflict in Israel and Palestine for decades, and they have consistently taken a position of peace based on justice and based on international law, and repeatedly called on both sides to respect international law, and particularly on Israel to respect international law. And so they have been involved in this, and they're now taking this approach, I think, because they are hoping that to have some practical impact to positively change the situation so that it does take a turn towards justice.
Is there a kind of frustration with the lack of response to what they've been doing heretofore?
Well, they have for nearly 40 years issued, various organizations have issued position papers and calling for an end to Israeli occupation, which they clearly identify as the main problem, the core of this conflict, calling on Israel to end its occupation. And those have gone unanswered and unnoticed as Israel continues to ignore international law and to continue to commit its persistent violations of Palestinian human rights.
Could you tell us some of the churches that are involved in this discussion of economic sanctions on Israel?
It's, despite reports to the contrary, it's quite a growing list. It started with the Presbyterian Church in the U.S. and then was picked up by the World Council of Churches, which has 210 member organizations, member churches around the world. And they called for all of their members to consider economic measures as a way to positively influence this situation so that it does take a turn towards peace and justice. Sabil, which is a Palestinian Christian theology center in Jerusalem, has issued a call for sanctions, boycott, and divestment for people to consider those aspects. In Canada, the United Church of Canada Toronto Conference has been organizing around this issue. The New England Conference of United Methodists, the Anglican Consultative Council, has issued a call for consideration of these as measures. The United Church of Christ, the Lutheran Church in the States, and the Episcopal Church.
So it's quite a range, quite a number of churches, and many of them are quite large churches.
Yes.
What has developed so far out of these discussions for considering economic sanctions? Have they proceeded beyond the general consideration that this should be done, or where are they at in different churches? Perhaps it's different.
It is different. It's a range of responses and how far churches have moved on this issue. And I do want to point out as well, I think it's important to note that these initiatives have very much come from the grassroots of the church. You know, I was doing a little research. I wanted to read what the resolutions were that were passed at the various churches. And so, for example, the General Synod of the United Church of Christ this past summer passed a resolution calling on its member churches to consider economic measures, including divestment. And then on there, they have a web page. And so I saw that specifically, and then I went to their front page, their home page of their website, and the lead story is that the church leaders commend Condoleezza Rice's leadership on the Israel-Palestine conflict. So, you know, you do see this real difference. The initiatives are very much coming from the grassroots, and quite often, as I heard at the conference that I attended, there is resistance from the church hierarchy, from the church leaders. So, but to get back to your specific question, where are all of these churches? A lot of them have begun just by passing resolutions to look into this matter, to consider the issue more carefully. So that's the case with the Anglican Consultative Council. It was a unanimous decision of that council, which is there to advise the Anglican Church. And so they are looking at proceeding with that. And then you have churches like the U.S. Presbyterian Church, which is more active or has moved farther along with it. And so they are looking at phased selective divestment. So they've actually selected five companies, and they are doing what is called constructive engagement. So they are, they've selected five companies that are involved in Israeli occupation, and they are working specifically with them to try and inform them about how their products or services are being used in the occupied territories, what those breaches of international law are, and to work with them to get them to stop selling their products to Israel, for instance. In the case of Caterpillar, that's a big campaign that the Presbyterian Church is involved in. And then in Canada, the United Church of Canada Toronto Conference, they went through an arduous process to have this resolution passed and spent a year educating all the presbyteries in the Toronto Conference before they got a successful resolution passed, and they have just had an implementation plan received as well. So they're proceeding with that.
Now, the Palestinian have also issued a call for economic sanctions against Israel. What Palestinian groups or what part of Palestinian society has issued that call?
Well, the Palestinian civil society issued a call on the first anniversary of the International Court of Justice decision. So that was July 9th, 2005. So it was 1 year after that quite remarkable decision of the International Court of Justice. And so civil society, this was at the time, it was 171 groups, and this list continues to grow. And it represents three important parts of the Palestinian people. It is includes Palestinian refugees, Palestinians living under occupation, and Palestinian citizens of Israel. And so those 171 groups come from these three different parts of the Palestinian people. And again, it's you know, very much a grassroots initiative. It is, you know, the Dentists Association, Palestinian Engineers, YMCA, the YWCA. It's, you know, Palestinian teachers and doctors and lawyers and soccer coaches and moms and dads and, you know, just you and me. It's these people who are just, they have had enough, and they are coming up with nonviolent responses that they can engage the international community with.
You mentioned it, excuse me, it was on the anniversary of the International Court of Justice decision. I assume that's the one on the wall, or judging that the wall is, in fact, illegal and they should be dismantled and so on.
Yes, yes. So that decision was in 2004. And that decision, you know, it does call for the wall to be dismantled and for Israel to pay compensation, but it also takes into account various aspects of the occupation and previous sort of rulings and resolutions on this issue, and it recognizes that the settlements in Gaza, which are now the settlements, are withdrawn, but that East Jerusalem and West Bank are also occupied territories and that those settlements are illegal.
How would you sort of compare the Palestinian call for boycott, sanction, and divestment with the kind of discussions that are going on in the churches? Are there some issues that arise when you look at both that really are still open for discussion and people should think about?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of issues that are that will be resolved within the communities, how different people think they can most effectively work in their own particular circumstances and within their own communities, taking into consideration the various aspects of the work and the people that they're working with. So the Palestinian call, for instance, it calls for respect of international law and dismantling of the wall. And it calls for the recognition of equal rights for all citizens in Israel, Palestinian Israelis and Jewish Israelis. And it calls for the right of return for Palestinian refugees. So that is what the Palestinian call, those are the parameters of the Palestinian call. And then you have other organizations where people want to target companies that are benefiting from occupation particularly. So it's looking at products from the settlements and boycotting those products specifically. It's looking at arms manufacturers. It's looking at, again, Caterpillar as a well-established campaign where the D9 bulldozers are being used to destroy Palestinian homes and lives in the occupied territories. So there are those issues, and they will, you know, and these were issues that I wasn't part of really the anti-apartheid campaign. You know, I did make sure as a teenager that those products didn't come into my home, but I wasn't sort of actively organizing with people. But I have looked at the history a bit, and it's my understanding that those differences were there in South African apartheid as well. There wasn't agreement on tactics, strategic choices that people made all the time. But as with the Palestinian call, there is the basic agreement that international law must be respected and the occupation must end. And that is the basis of agreement there.
The supporters of Israel are known to launch the charge of anti-Semitism against most critical response to Israeli state policies that is motivated by intent or by unconsciously by some hatred of Jews. And this must be something that when churches faced with a charge of this, that must be, particularly in Christian churches, there must be a great deal of anxiety about that. What sort of responses did you hear discussed at the conference in terms of these kind of charges being made against people who are trying to use nonviolent methods of economic pressure to bring about Israeli compliance with international law and major United Nations resolutions?
Well, I'd like to first share my own sort of personal experience with that, and then two reflections from people at this conference. And so, you know, I've been working in sort of Palestine solidarity, calling for respect for Palestinian human rights for about 5 years. And so that involves standing with a banner or being out leafleting and, you know, leafleting before people even read the leaflet to know what it is that I'm saying or what position I take on this issue. You know, I've been called anti-Semitic, I've been called a Nazi, I've been called a supporter of Hitler. And that's not fun. You don't, you know, it's uncomfortable. You don't want to hear that. You don't want to have people yelling those things at you. And so there were moments where I thought, what am I doing standing out on this street? But that never came from a place of that I... from a moral perspective that I morally shouldn't be out here. It came from personally being uncomfortable about it. And so you just develop a thicker skin about it. I'm self-respecting in my support for Palestinian human rights and in my opposition to anti-Semitism. And I know that about myself, and I know that about the people that I work with and the positions that I support. So it's, again, it's still never fun to be yelled at, but... it is easier to be out on the street and to know within myself that I am being morally responsible and that we have a responsibility to stand up to injustice. And so at this conference, this was a question that was raised. And so one example, Michael Pierce, who is the former primate of the Anglican Church, gave his personal account of these charges. And you know, he told a very personal story of hearing what anti-Semitism is around his dinner table as a young man from a member of his family. And, you know, he says from that experience, he knows very clearly what anti-Semitism is. And when he is charged with it, he does not let it dislodge, disempower, or disorient him. And he just keeps doing the work that he knows needs to be done in the cause of peace and justice. And there was also another man that spoke, David Wildman, and I believe he is part of the Methodist Church, but I'm not certain of his church affiliation. But he was there speaking as a member of the U.S. campaign against Israeli occupation. And he was asked this question, and he asked us to... spend less time responding to these spurious charges and to spend more time doing the work that needs to be done. That these are diversionary tactics, much like, you know, is he considered sort of Jewish-Christian dialogue groups, that these are just intended to bog us down in these discussions and not move ahead with the work that needs to be done on a clear understanding of peace and justice.
Well, thank you very much for coming in this morning, Erica.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Erica Lammercraft. She's a member of Canada-Palestine Support Network. She's also active in the Wall Must Fall campaign, and that campaign currently is discussing the tactic of economic sanctions. And if you'd like to become involved in this campaign, you can check out the website, www.thewallmustfall.ca. The Wall Must Fall, all one word.
Victoria's sewage disposal is under scrutiny. Environmental groups are using data issued by the Capital Regional District to call for measures to protect the seabed and its marine life for future generations. Each year, the city dumps billions of liters of raw sewage into the Georgia Strait. This week, the Georgia Strait Alliance issued an urgent plea to the provincial government to declare the seabed under Victoria's sewage outfalls as contaminated sites. Christiane Wilhelmsen is with the Georgia Strait Alliance, and she joins me by phone this morning. Good morning, Christiane.
Good morning, Jane.
What is meant exactly? What do you want the meaning of contaminated sites to be?
Well, there are regulations and guidelines both at the federal and provincial level which have established what a contaminated site is, and it is when you have levels of particular contaminants that are over a certain level. So this has already been established. Science has already been used to establish these levels. And what we did was we looked at the CRD zone data. They monitor the seabed every year and publish those results. We simply took those numbers, compared them to provincial regulations and federal guidelines, and found that the levels of 19 out of 33 compounds were exceeding the limits that have been set through contaminated site regulations. So, in essence, the seabed should qualify as a contaminated site. So we simply asked the province to review our data and start the process for dealing with the seabed as a contaminated site.
So this is nothing new. The regulations are there. The standards are set. All the data is in.
That is true. It is simply that we looked at it through a different lens. One thing to understand is that the Capital Regional District has their own guidelines for sediment contamination. However, they're significantly weaker than provincial and federal regulations. Now, why the municipality has different regulations, I can't answer that. I don't know. But they're much, much weaker. So every year, the CRD does compare their data to their own regulations. And every year, everything's fine. But when you have much weaker regulations, there are no red flags that'll go up.
So every municipality can just set their own guidelines?
Well, I don't know how to answer that because I've never heard of this before. My understanding was always that provincial and federal guidelines on things around environmental protection would supersede municipal guidelines. But in this case, that doesn't seem to be the case. Neither the province nor the federal government has used their own regulations to force the Capital Regional District to deal with this problem. And the way to deal with this problem is to get secondary sewage treatment for the city of Victoria.
There seems to be such a conflict of interest because, of course, municipalities are going to be producing the sewage.
Exactly. So, and what's also interesting about this is that the seabed is actually the property of the province. So the province right now is not even protecting its own property, so to speak, with the regulations they have in hand. The Capital Regional District has a philosophy that sewage can be, quote-unquote, treated by the natural environment. But, of course, with all the chemicals, as we've shown in this report, that go out every day in raw sewage, there's no way that the environment can treat it in any way. It's just becoming part of the natural environment, part of the food web, and, you know, eventually could end up on our plates.
What kind of things particularly alarmed you in the data that you studied?
Well, there are things like a lot of heavy metals, copper, lead, that are exceeding regulations, and a very large number of organic compounds, which are toxic to marine life and have carcinogenic impacts. So, you know, what they're doing to the marine life, where we have a large variety of fish, and of course the southern resident killer whales that are endangered in both Canada and the U.S. swim through these waters. So they're being exposed to these toxic chemicals on a daily basis.
And as you said, then you have a concern that these will then, apart from the concern about the sea life itself, but also that will then end up on our dinner plates?
Exactly, because if chemicals enter the food chain, they eventually will end up in the fish that we eat. Now, of course, shellfish harvesting is banned in a 60-kilometer area around Victoria, so you won't be eating mussels or anything like that are coming from that area. You can't. It's simply not, they would not pass the health tests. But it means these chemicals are floating outside of that 60-kilometer zone, so fish and so on could be affected by it. And as I said, there are solutions to this problem. Victoria must start treating its sewage, and it's a continual battle to get the Capital Regional District to view sewage treatment as a viable option.
Well, you say it's a continual battle, and it's like my impression this has been going on for a very long time, and people have been criticizing the Capital District mm-hmm. for a long time. And has anything changed?
No, in essence, 30 years ago, Victoria they saw that their beaches were polluted with everything that comes out of the sewage pipe, and so what they decided, rather, even though it had been recommended at the time by scientists that secondary sewage treatment was the way to go, they chose rather to build two long pipes, and so the pipes simply pipe the sewage further away, so the they can't see it. Now, Capital Regional District is putting a lot of efforts into source control, and they should be commended for that, and source control is an important part.
What do you mean by source control?
Source control is simply educating people, both businesses and individuals, not to put the chemicals that do cause harm down the drain, and that's businesses, whether it's a dentist office or what you use in your home, your laundry soap and so on, or so there's education about how to reduce chemical input into the sewage system. However, there are two fundamental problems with using that as your sole means of sewage treatment. One of them is that it doesn't deal with a lot of the chemicals that are finding their way into the water. Copper, for example, is coming from the pipes, so there is no way to control that at the source. The other problem with source control is it takes a long time. It's education. People have to learn about the chemicals that are finding their way into the system, and it's a system which it's kind of a system that relies on everybody agreeing to do this. I will not dump oil down the drain. I will not dump these chemicals down the drain. Well, that's a kind of a faith-based system that is important to have, but it won't solve all the problems. Sewage treatment is the only way to keep those chemicals out of the water.
So why are they dragging their feet so much? Is it the cost?
Well, I don't have a straightforward answer to that. The CRD is floating a highly overinflated number that they are using really to scare the people of Victoria into thinking their taxes will go through the roof with sewage treatment. But the number, nobody in Canada has ever paid that much for, like the number they're throwing around is about $400 million, and nobody in Canada has paid that much for a sewage treatment plant at the secondary level. So I think at one point it probably was money. Now I simply think there's a philosophy within the Capital Regional District that they must defend the decisions they made decades ago, and they're doing everything in their power to do that, and it's a very, very short-sighted view of responsibility.
So we made a bad decision back then, so we have to continue making the same bad decision.
It would seem to be that. There's certainly both staff and some board members of the CRD are firmly convinced that dumping raw sewage and all the chemicals that are in that is not a problem. It does no harm to the environment, which there's growing, mounting evidence that simply is not true. But we're having a great deal of difficulty trying to change that attitude. This is why we went ahead and asked the provincial government to use regulations that are already on the books to try to... The contaminated sewage regulations have a structure that allow us to start dealing with the problem. So let's use the regulations on the books to help the CRD start discussing the issue, rather than whether we should or not have sewage treatment. How are we going to do it?
So what response have you had from the provincial government?
Currently, they've received our request within the last week, and they are looking at it. And so we have not had any... It's going to take some time for them to review the information and make their decision, but it seems rather obvious that when you have 19 of 33 chemicals exceeding contaminated sites regulation, that something needs to be done. So we're very hopeful that they will act on this and use this opportunity to bring sewage treatment to Victoria.
To bring it back home to us here in Vancouver, how does the GVRD, the Greater Vancouver Regional District sewage treatment, compare with Victoria's? Are we doing a better job here?
I guess that's a yes and no answer. We do treat all our sewage. However, our two largest plants, Lionsgate and Iona, are only primary sewage treatment plants, and therefore a lot of the chemicals, and Vancouver's a highly, much more industrialized city, a lot more chemicals are going into the system. If you look at Victoria, who doesn't treat their sewage, and Vancouver that treats their sewage at a primary level, if you look at it from a volume perspective, we're contributing probably as many chemicals as Victoria is. So Vancouver definitely needs to step up and start treating its sewage at a secondary level at all five of its treatment plants. There are plans to do this in their liquid waste management plan, but they're not for another 20 to 40 years, and that's far too long.
Well, if people are concerned about this, what can they do to kind of move things along? Where should they apply pressure?
It needs to be applied at the GVRD level. They are the ones who make the decisions. So if they have if one of their counselors and where they live is on the GVRD board, then I would suggest that they contact them. I think, putting pressure on our municipal politicians and having them push that along to the GVRD level is definitely important. We need to open up the discussion again so that we can bring secondary sewage treatment to Vancouver much sooner.
Well, thanks for talking to me this morning, Christiane.
You're very welcome.
I've been speaking with Christiane Well-Helmsen. She's with the Georgia Strait Alliance. If you want to check out their website, you can go to georgiastrait.org.